Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Friday, March 26, 2021. Section A. China aid leader. Biden isn't living up to Trump's more coherent policy on China. Fu, Trump was the first American president the CCP was really afraid of. By Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N at HurstNP.com. Editor's note. The Reporter Telegram had a chance to catch up with Bob Fu of China Aid. We are offering highlights of that discussion today and inside the weekend edition. In October, Bob Fu had Chinese communists protesting in his front yard. Not exactly the best of times for Fu, his family, or their North Midland neighbors. The multi-week protest gave Midlanders a taste of the threat that Fu deals with on a constant basis. Still, Fu, the leader of the Midland nonprofit China Aid, told the Reporter Telegram that he is grateful for the protection he received from law enforcement, the FBI, and Mayor Patrick Peyton. He also wanted to thank the Midland community for its prayers for him and his family, which moved from location to location out of the state during the ordeal. Fu, reflecting on the events of last fall, recalled Peyton telling Midlanders that he's been through three difficult situations during his time as mayor: COVID, an economic downturn, and Chinese protesters in his city. Two of them are related to China, Fu pointed out. Fu was pleased that the White House, today at NATO headquarters, identified China as the number one security threat to NATO. It was an improvement, he said, to an opening act that Fu said raised questions whether the president is naive or had acknowledged defeat. Fu referenced the high-level meeting between the Chinese and Americans in Alaska when the Chinese lectured the U.S. for its human rights record of late. That was real sad to see on your own soil, that somehow the Communist Party leaders would lecture top leaders in the U.S. for 20 minutes is astonishing, said Fu, referencing the genocide of more than 1 million, mostly moderate Muslims, in concentration camps and the placing of Christians in prison for as much as 12 years for offering sermons. Fu said President Biden made a serious mistake with the tone his administration set. Now is not the time for strategic ambiguity. Strategic clarity is needed, Fu said, adding the officials with the Chinese Communist Party are masters of deception and masters of rhetoric, and that they talk without changing behavior. It has been that way since Jimmy Carter's time, said Fu, a participant in the Tiananmen Square protests in 1989. Fu has been consistent in his comments about administrations, even when George W. Bush occupied the Oval Office. In an interview he gave once, Fu gave the Bush administration an F for its China policy. He said while the former Midlander got higher marks for religious freedom, that it accommodated China's business interests way too much. Fu said Donald Trump earned the highest marks of any recent president. His China policy has been the best, the most coherent, said Fu, referencing conversations with those still in China that confirmed his thinking. He said Trump's strategy was the most comprehensive when dealing with the power that China has become. That is why Communist Party leaders decided before he left office to enact a wait-and-see approach, Fu said. He was the first American president the CCP was really afraid of. Fu hopes the current administration is tougher on the Chinese, which he said was active in the November election. He said the U.S. cannot allow CCP civilian and social media companies to operate in the U.S. without impunity or raising money without obeying conscientious rules. It was wrong for this administration to reverse the policies in place with executive actions, Fu said. When facing evil, you don't dare declare a ceasefire. Daniel's Law Passes Texas House by Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N at HurstNP.com. The Texas House sent Daniel's Law to the Senate. Daniel's Law is House Bill 119, and it prohibits organ transplant recipient discrimination on the basis of certain disabilities. The Reporter-Telegram earlier this month reported on Midlander's role in advocating for those with special needs to be able to receive life-saving organ transplants. Kathleen Kerwin Haney told the Reporter-Telegram earlier this month that her brother Daniel had been denied testing to be put on a donor list for a kidney because he has Down syndrome. Daniel died at the age of 46 from renal failure. State Representative Brooks Landgraf of Odessa was one of four authors of Daniel's Law, according to the Texas Legislature Online. The bill had its third reading, a record vote, and the unofficial totals show 145 House members voting for it, including Landgraf and Tom Craddock, and none against. I am grateful to Brooks Landgraf and his hardworking staff for their dedication and hard work in getting this legislation through the House, Kerwin Haney wrote to the Reporter-Telegram. We are thrilled with this outcome, but our work is not done. The next step is getting through the Senate. We need support. Please take less than a minute to complete a petition to sign to Senator Kel Seliger, letting him know Texas Meds needs Daniel's Law to ensure special needs individuals are not discriminated against regarding organ donations based solely on their disability. There is a companion bill in the Senate, Senate Bill 1017 by Judith Zaffarini of Laredo. Fortunes change for a homeless woman, but not her companion. Dear Abby, I used to be a successful working woman until I lost my husband of 30 years. After I became homeless, I met Tom. We've been good friends for the last 5 years, hanging out in the woods, sometimes getting hotel rooms. It's a platonic relationship, but we rely on each other. I receive Social Security survivor benefits now, and I want to move on and get my own place. He said he's fine with it, but I feel terribly guilty. He gets a small disability check, but is not wise with money. How can I comfort him? Signed, Guilty in Florida. Dear Guilty, Tom has told you he's fine with you upgrading your living situation. I presume that you don't intend to desert him. Believe him and stop flogging yourself for your good fortune. Help him when you can and encourage him to contact an agency that helps the homeless so he can get his life back on track too. Dear Abby, I'm in a same-sex relationship with a woman I love and admire, but 5 months in, sex is becoming impossible because I think I'm heterosexual. Leaving this relationship scares me because I can't imagine a life without her. I told her I don't know if, for several reasons, sex would be a part of our relationship, but that I do love her. She doesn't seem to mind at all. I'm not sure what to do. Please help. Signed, Loving in Louisiana. Dear Loving, what you need to do is be honest with your partner. It is possible that you are bisexual and need to explore relationships with men before making up your mind about any permanent relationship. If sex is important to you, then the person you wind up with may not be this woman you love and admire, but someone else entirely. Dear Abby, my grandson died by suicide in 2019. My daughter, who lives in another state, hasn't spoken to me since. Why? Because we did not call her on the phone. We were texting her, but she was texting us back. When I did try to call, she wouldn't answer the phone. It has been more than a year now. She won't respond to other family members either. Please advise me what to do in this sad situation. Signed, Wounded Grandma in Texas. Dear Grandma, not knowing your daughter, I'm hesitant to guess why she has isolated herself from everyone. She may have felt she was entitled to more support from you all and didn't receive it. As many people have pointed out in my column, while texts may be efficient, they are a poor substitute for a human voice. Because she refuses your calls, write her a letter telling her you love her and apologize for letting her down after the tragedy of losing her son. Whether it will help, I can't guess, but at least the olive branch will have been offered. Obituaries and death notices. John Eagle Casey, longtime resident of Midland, passed away March 24th. Funeral services will be at 2 p.m. Saturday, March 27th at First United Methodist Church. Interment will follow in Rest Haven Cemetery. Services and arrangements are entrusted to Nellie Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Mallorini Millie Duncan, 72, died on February 15th in Crane. The family will receive guests from 6:30 to 9 p.m. Friday, March 26th at Nellie Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home. A service is being held at 7 p.m. Funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, March 27th at the funeral home with interment following at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home. John Anthony Gutierrez, 44, of Midland, passed away on Tuesday, March 23rd. Viewing will be held on Saturday, March 27th from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. with an evening service at 7 p.m. at Heavenly Gate Funeral Home Chapel. Wallace Sparkman, 90, of Midland, passed away on March 24th. Public viewing will be held from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. Sunday, March 28th at Nellie Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home. Visitation will be from 10 to 11 a.m. at Gribble Springs Baptist Church. Funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Tuesday, March 30th at Gribble Springs Baptist Church in Denton County. Austin's School Links and Ramble raise a combined $13 million for expansion. Midland ISD is a customer for the Career and College Planning Platform Operator by Lori Hawkins, Austin American Statesman. Two Austin companies, one an education tech firm, the other an IT asset management startup, have raised a combined $13.3 million. School Links received $8.3 million in a deal led by Austin-based Live Oak Venture Partners with participation from SJF Ventures and Juvo Ventures, founded in 2015 by entrepreneur Katie Fang. School Links offers a career and college planning platform aimed at helping diverse students for who plan to attend college as well as those who are seeking career paths after high school. The platform also lets school districts track various education metrics required by state and federal mandates. School Links customers include San Antonio, Dallas, and Midland Independent School Districts, and Greenville County Schools in South Carolina. Changing legislation at state level and evolving market conditions are putting a spotlight on school districts' ability to set their students up for success in the job market, regardless of whether they attend a four-year college or not. The School Links platform is designed for students beginning in sixth grade, along with their families and counselors. Students can explore their interests through assessments and learn about college and career options, job and internship opportunities, and how to seek scholarships and finance post-secondary schools. Education Briefs from Staff Reports. Andrews High School's Audrey Blanco has signed a letter of intent with Wayland Baptist University in Plainview. She tried out and was selected for the squad and will now receive a scholarship as well. Blanco is a three-year letter-winning cheerleader and was named varsity captain this past year. She is a three-time All-American nominee, two-time All-American cheerleader. Rotary Students of the Week. Benjamin Yates, School Greenwood, School Activities, Varsity Basketball, Team Captain, National Honor Society, Student Leadership Coalition, Community Activities, led a Hoops Against Hunger campaign. Honors and Awards, Superintendent's Award for Academic Excellence, All-District Basketball Team, Academic All-District, Greenwood Basketball Fighting Heart Award. Future Place, Study Finance and Statistics at Texas A&M, University of Houston, or Ohio State University. Demi Anders, School Midland High, School Activities, Varsity Volleyball for 3 years, Varsity Soccer for 4 years, Varsity Basketball for 1 year, Students in philanthropy and National Honor Society, community activities, member of Young Life and National Honor Society activities, honors and awards, member of the National Honor Society of High School Scholars, team captain for volleyball for 3 years, team captain for soccer for 2 years, academic all-state for volleyball 3 years, academic all-district, newcomer of the year, first team all-district for volleyball and soccer. Future plans, attend Texas Tech University and major in chemical engineering and minor in business. Dean's list at Dickinson College. Caitlin Lawrenson, a junior chemistry major at Dickinson College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, has been named to the Dean's List for the fall of 2020 semester. She is a graduate of Midland High School. Abilene Christian University's Fall 2020 Dean's Honor Roll List. More than 1,300 students were named to the Fall 2020 Dean's List at Abilene Christian. To qualify for the Dean's List, Dean's Honor Roll, students must be registered for 12 or more credit hours and earn a GPA of 3.6 or higher. The following students from Midland made the list: Becca Condor, junior majoring in art; Mason Cochran, sophomore majoring in biology; Alex Wall, senior majoring in physical science; Stefan Truitt, senior majoring in history; Bralee Chestnut, a freshman majoring in English for teaching; Katie Wall, sophomore majoring in English for teaching; Olivia Peters, freshman majoring in engineering; Matthew Madison, a sophomore majoring in accounting; Cammie Stokes, a sophomore majoring in accounting; Daphne Williams, a senior majoring in child and family services; Andy Shepherd, a sophomore majoring in nutrition; Abby Claire Brown, a senior majoring in nursing; Gold Egott, a freshman majoring in nursing. The University of Kansas Honor Roll has more than 7,100 undergraduate students who earned Honor Roll distinction for the Fall 2020 semester. They include Britton Murray, College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. Bailey Leonard of Midland has been named to the Provost List at Troy University for Term 3 of the 21-20 academic year. The Provost List honors full-time undergraduate students who are registered for at least 12 semester hours and who have a grade point average of at least 3.65. Midland Young Leaders extends application deadline. The deadline to apply for Midland Young Leaders Challenge, MYLC, has been extended. Current high school juniors now have until April 3rd to complete their applications. Students from the class of 2022 and from Midland ISD, Greenwood, private schools, and homeschools are eligible to apply. The General Tommy Franks Leadership Institute also announced full speaker lineup for this year's event. The following speakers will complement previously announced keynote speaker, retired Army Major General Tony Kukala: Elizabeth Rainey, Midland County Drug Court Judge; Alan Bell, Director of Midland County Adult Probation; Jessica Rule, President SHK Advertising; and Luis Sanchez, Midland County Commissioner. The Midland Young Leaders Challenge is a world-class leadership program open to an elite group of top-performing rising high school seniors in Midland County, free of charge. Thanks to community partners, the Midland Young Leaders Challenge offers $6,000 in scholarships for writing and speech contests and for participants who demonstrate overall leadership potential. Midland College Profiles by Rebecca Bell. Pathway program helps students to medical school. Three Midland County High School graduates are now one step closer to medical school. Zainab Falana, Enrique Mikey Mangan, and Jonathan Michael, John Michael, Mark Graff have all been accepted to Texas College of Osteopathic Medicine and will either enter medical school in summer of 2022. The students will graduate this coming May from Midland College with an Associate of Science degree through MC's Primary Care Pathway program. This coming August, they will enter the University of North Texas, UNT, and spend 1 year there taking upper-level science courses before entering TCOM. What all this means is that before obtaining their associate degrees, the three students have been accepted to medical school without having to take the rigorous and expensive MCAT medical school entrance exam. In just 6 to 7 years after high school graduation, they will enter a medical residency program, an accomplishment that normally takes 8 years at a minimum. All three indicated that they want to return to Midland to practice medicine. Zainab said that she knew she wanted to be a physician when she was a sophomore at Midland High. "I lost my father when I was in the 10th grade," Falana said. "My mom has a friend who is a doctor, and she really helped my family through our grieving process. I had always been good in math and science and thought that I might want to go to medical school. However, the compassion that my mom's friend showed to our family made me realize that I wanted to not only be able to help people through skill, but also have the opportunity to be compassionate to fellow humans. There are 4 children in my family, and I wasn't sure I would be able to attend medical school because of finances. A high school counselor told me about MC's Primary Care Pathway program, and I was immediately interested. I could stay home for 2 years and obtain great scholarships through Midland College." Falana is the daughter of Falilat Falana and was the 2019 Midland High School valedictorian. Her family moved to Houston from Nigeria when Zainab was 9. Her father's job in the oil and gas industry eventually caused a job transfer to Midland. Zainab's mother works at H&R Block in Midland. Zainab currently works for 20 hours a week as a medical scribe at Midland Memorial Hospital. Ricky Mangan is the son of Yomar and Michael Mangan. Unlike most of the students in the Primary Care Path program who spend 2 years studying in MC, Mickey will have only spent 1 year after high school graduation. He actually received an associate degree from MC in 2020 at the same time that he received his high school diploma from Early College High School at MC. Mickey has spent the 2021 school year taking additional science courses at MC. "When I first heard about the Primary Care Pathway program, it sounded too good to be true. I am very grateful for this program. If all goes as planned, I will have a medical degree within 6 years after graduating from high school." Currently, Mickey's goal is to become a diagnostic radiologist, but he said that may change as he encounters his clinicals rotations during medical school. "I'm really interested in technology and medicine," he said. "Radiology has historically been the leader in applying technological advancements to workflow and patient care. That trend shows no slackening." John Michael Markgraf graduated from Midland Classical Academy in 2019. He said that his parents, Stephanie and Jim Markgraf, instilled in him a sense of service to others. "Throughout high school, I volunteered as a tutor to children who were living at Midland Fair Havens. When I was a senior in high school, I took an anatomy and physiology course and really enjoyed it. That's when I decided that becoming a physician will be a good avenue for an enjoyable career where I can help others." Mark Graff currently tutors college students who are wanting to get into nursing school. MC Associate Professor of Biology Joseph Schenkman serves as coordinator of the Primary Care Pathway Program. He explained that the purpose of the program is to increase the number of physicians practicing primary care in the Midland area and in the state of Texas. The program contains the following components: an enhanced 3-year pre-med curriculum that includes 2 years at MC and 1 year at UNT, healthcare enrichment activities that include mentoring and physician shadowing, and a summer enrichment experience. So far, 20 program graduates have been accepted into TCOM. To be eligible for MC's Primary Care Pathway program, high school graduates must have competitive college entrance exam scores and be U.S. citizens or permanent residents with Texas residency. Dual credit coursework may be accepted at the discretion of the program committee. Since the Primary Care Pathway program's inception in 2016, participants have completed more than 2,000 community service hours, averaging 100 hours per student. and more than 1,000 health care-related service learning hours. While at MC, the students have also participated in more than 1,500 clinical training hours at Midland Memorial Hospital, averaging 75 hours per student. The average GPA for program participants graduating from MC is 3.8, and the average GPA for program students at UNT is 3.9. Schenkman said that students who successfully complete all the requirements in the prescribed time frame while maintaining at least a 3.5 GPA may be granted an interview that can lead to an offer of early acceptance admission to TCOM. Additionally, by attaining all only A's and B's while maintaining the 3.8 GPA, the submission of an MCAT score will be waived. Falana, Mangan, and Markgraf are three of those students. Schenkman further explained that, in addition to partnering with UNT, the program's success can also be attributed to a third partner, Midland Memorial Hospital. Because of the relentless efforts of our two partners, the Midland Community, University of North Texas Health Science Center, and, of course, Midland College faculty, staff, and administration, these students have continued to gain the foundation necessary to continue their success beyond Midland and Midland College. The fact that Zainab, Ricky, and John Michael want to return to Midland to practice medicine and give back to this community says a lot about the support they have received. Midland College has provided these students the tools and support for their success, but it is their drive and motivation toward medicine that makes them truly successful. Sixth grader delivers second straight title for Young Women's Leadership Academy by Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N, at HearstMP.com. For the second straight year, the winner of the Reporter-Telegram Regional Spelling Bee was a student from Young Women's Leadership Academy. Swetha Jayakumar beat out comers to take the title inside the Allison Fine Arts Center at Midland College on Saturday. Jayakumar, a sixth grader, will represent Midland at the 2021 Scripps National Spelling Bee. This year, regional champions like Jayakumar will have a chance to advance through three levels of virtual competitions to qualify for the finals, which will be July 8th in Orlando, Florida. It took 13 rounds for Jayakumar to claim her title, finishing off the field after spelling neurility, the special properties and functions of the nerves, and then celiac, of relating to or located in the cavity of the abdomen in the championship round. Tofumi Okimi of Abel Junior High finished second, and Mallory Dominguez of Boy Fine Arts Academy was third. Jayakumar defeated last year's champion, Sanjana Vadlapatla, in their school spelling bee, and actually expected Vadlapatla to have an automatic spot in the regional bee as the defending champion. That was not the case, but Jayakumar's father provided motivation for Swetha as he promised her the next in the series of Harry Potter books if she got through the entire list of word spellers were provided to prepare for the regional spelling bee. As it turned out, the finalists went to a list of words they hadn't seen prior to the contest. As Jayakumar stated afterward, the higher level of words created the need to guess, which in spelling bee language means to break down the word down using roots, ask for definitions, and language of origins. When she finally got her opportunity at a championship word, celiac, she said she was so nervous and that a million combinations were going through her mind. However, she picked the right one. I did put in the hours and I did put in the work, so I'm really happy that it all paid off. Okimi is an eighth grader at Abel Junior High and a returnee to the Reporter-Telegram Spelling Bee. He said his preparation and relentless pushing from his parents helped improve his performance. Okimi actually had his own championship word during the competition, but just missed a boombrate, which means to darken, overshadow, or cloud. Okimi got a look at Midland College, where he will take classes next year at Early College High School at Midland College. He's also a soccer player. In fact, he missed his team's first game on Saturday. I think they'll understand, Okemi said, of his missing the game. Focus on education. Highlighting the achievements and progress of MISD. Spirit of service is alive in today's students. Midland ISD graduate finds creative ways to improve his community. One of the most important lessons students learn at MISD is serving their community. One student who took that lesson to heart was 2019 MISD graduate Felix Hinosa. As a senior at LHS, Hinosa was researching ways he could complete his 40 hours of community service for Midland College's Legacy Scholar Program when he realized MISD was on their approved list. At the time, Hinosa was doing landscaping work to save for college expenses. That's when he approached a teacher about his idea. Use his community service hours and experience to beautify the campus around him. He would volunteer his time and energy to help his coaches with the time-consuming work of setting up and maintaining the baseball fields, and also help with picking up litter around the school. Several of his baseball teammates joined in, and they quickly had a group of four or five spending their evenings after practice weeding and mowing, manning concession stands during JV games, and taking pride in their school grounds. Hinosa's pride in his campus extended beyond graduation. Legacy Scholar Program students are required to continue volunteering each year they're in the program. Hinosa chose to continue volunteering at LHS to help his former coaches and teammates. Along with preparing students for college and career, MISD also aims to prepare students to be active members in the community, whether in leadership roles or simply volunteering their time. Small acts of kindness can change lives, and MISD strives to instill a community-minded spirit in students from the first day they enter our hallways, said Elena Ladd, Chief Communications Officer for MISD. It's wonderful to see how that passion for giving back can continue well after graduation. Hinosa credits his parents with instilling a strong drive to volunteer and give back to his community. They taught me that you don't always have to make money to be satisfied in what you're doing, he said. Knowing that you're helping people is what is satisfying. UT Austin won't require SAT or ACT scores for the 2022 applications. By Kate McGee, Texas Tribune. The University of Texas at Austin is suspending the SAT and ACT test scores requirement for fall 2022 applicants, citing continued limited access to testing opportunities for students due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The continuation of the temporary suspension will ensure that testing limitations related to COVID-19 do not affect a student's ability to apply to be considered for admission to UT Austin, the university said in a statement. The flagship university is the latest among schools across the country to extend the temporary hold on the traditional application requirement. Earlier this year, multiple Ivy League universities and others had extended their test optional policies through 2022. In Texas, Rice University in Houston made the similar announcement. The University of Houston system also said it would remain test optional through fall 2022 and would consider making the change permanent. Baylor University also made the standardized tests optional through fall 2023 and said it will reevaluate the policy for future years. Texas A&M University also has extended its policy to 2022 applicants and anticipates 2023 will be test optional as well. Last year, multiple Texas universities temporarily scrapped the testing requirement for 2021 applicants as the College Board canceled test exams and large exam sites were closed, including Texas A&M University, Texas Tech, Texas Christian, and Southern Methodist. SMU also announced Thursday that they would remain test optional for fall 2022 and spring 2023 admissions.
This article is called Small Bites. It's entitled, Baby Mango Snack Bar is a Dream Come True for Midland College Graduate, by J.C. Lewis. Baby Mango Snack Bar opened on March 10th at 4411 West Illinois Avenue. Owner Angelica Estrada moved to Midland about 10 years ago and went to school at Midland College. She graduated from Midland College with an associate's degree in business and decided to open a snack, juice, and smoothie bar. I'm from Mexico, and I got the idea for Baby Mango from shops in Mexico, she said. I bring everything from Mexico, so it tastes like you're eating our items in Mexico. Her favorite items on the menu are the elote or corn options, including elote en vas regular, elote con frituras, with Takis or Hot Cheetos, elote coreado, and elote en palo. All the snacks are brought from Mexico, except for the Hot Cheetos. Estrada said she wanted to do something with her business degree and decided a snack, smoothie, and juice bar would be interesting. She saved most of her money to open the snack bar, which ended up costing more than double what was originally expected. The menu also features Chilindrina, fresas con crema, pinolada, mangonada, fruit mixes with yogurt, granola, limon or chamoy, and more. The juice bar has juices to help with diabetes, cholesterol, colon, skin, and one with plenty of vitamins. The Jugo Verde juice is made of cactus, celery, pineapple, and orange. Snack options include Takis, Flamin' Hot Cheetos, Chicharrones, Ramen, Squinkles, Rellenos, and more. The shop also has ice cream and agua frescas. She said she hopes to add coffee for the winter season. The snack bar has extra seating if customers want a seat and work. She said she would also like to add an option for people to celebrate birthdays or other events. The snack bar is open from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., Tuesday through Sunday. Local chef to be on TV. Curbside Bistro's chef and owner Alejandro Barrientos will be appearing on Food Network's Beat Bobby Flay. On April 22nd, Chef Alejandro will be featured on Season 27, Episode 11, according to a Facebook post. Curbside Bistro was originally a food truck, but is now located at 3816 Andrews Highway in Odessa. The restaurant serves gourmet sliders, fries, chicken wings, tacos, and more. Barrientos also opened the Beer Barn, previously the Barbecue Barn, next door to the restaurant, which is a drive-through convenience store, serving beer, energy drinks, micheladas, fountain drinks, and other beverages. This is a dream come true, and is all due to the blessing of God and the amazing support from our community, Barrientos said in a Facebook post. This article is entitled API Mull's Embrace of Carbon Pricing, by Jennifer A. DeLuey, Bloomberg. The American Petroleum Institute is considering throwing its weight behind a government-imposed price on carbon dioxide emissions as a way to show global warming, a major policy shift by the oil industry's top trade group. API's draft policy statement does not endorse a specific mechanism, such as a tax on carbon dioxide emissions or a cap-and-trade system, but endorses what it calls a market-based, economy-wide policy, according to two people familiar with the discussions. It could receive a vote by the group's executive board later this week. Proponents argue that a carbon tax that increases the cost of energy derived from oil, natural gas, and coal could be more effective than regulations at paring U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. Such a tax, the proceeds of which could be rebated to consumers, would discourage the use of fossil fuels while encouraging the market to develop low-carbon alternatives. The Chamber of Commerce embraced market-based policies to limit emissions in January, and several of API's largest members, including ExxonMobil Group, ConocoPhillips, BP PLC, and Royal Dutch Shell PLC already support a carbon tax and rebate program. Getting a market price on carbon is going to be really important to make sure that we're using market forces to try most cost-effectively to reduce CO2 emissions. Exxon's Chief Executive Officer, ExxonMobil Chief Executive Officer Darren Woods said at the CERA Week by IHS Market Conference Tuesday, governments should not pick winners and losers. The efforts have gained momentum as international energy companies are making investment decisions based on the assumption that emission limits will be imposed by regulation, tax, or other mechanisms. The companies are seeking regulatory certainty on the issue instead of environmental policies that whipsaw with every presidential election. And they are bracing for possible tariffs on imports from countries with lax climate policies, a potential risk for U.S. companies selling carbon-intensive products globally. API previously telegraphed its support in January when it said it supported the ambitions of the Paris Agreement to pair greenhouse gas emissions and cited, quote, market-based policies, unquote, such as carbon pricing, as a way to balance those reductions with flexibility and pacing to keep energy affordable. API Senior Vice President of Communications Megan Blomgren said the group has convened top energy officials throughout the supply chain to incubate a host of policy solutions and industry actions to shape a lower carbon future. Our efforts are focused on supporting a new U.S. contribution to the Global Paris Agreement, Blomgren said by email. Consideration of API's move was earlier reported by the Wall Street Journal. Some environmentalists who oppose fossil fuel development criticized the possible move, with Maya Golden-Krasner, Deputy Director of the Center for Biological Diversity's Climate Law Institute, calling it, quote, little more than a public relations ploy, unquote. Instead of letting producers buy their way out of climate accountability, we need strong regulations to keep fossil fuels in the ground, Golden-Krasner said. The effort divides the oil and gas industry. Some large integrated energy companies that have global operations and investments in low-carbon businesses favor the approach. Many independent oil producers and refiners are opposed. Natural gas. A carbon tax could benefit producers of natural gas over coal and spur investment in renewables and nuclear power. Several utilities have lobbied Biden administration officials to support a nationwide carbon price. And Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, who previously endorsed a carbon tax as the textbook solution to climate change, reiterated in January that effective carbon pricing is essential to solve the climate crisis. I am fully supportive of effective carbon pricing, and I know that the president is as well, Yellen said in written answers to Senate Finance Committee questions. Nevertheless, the politics of the issue are challenging, particularly in the Senate, which voted 50-50 along party lines last month to block a measure that would have opposed a carbon tax. Senator Joe Manchin, whose role representing coal-rich West Virginia and heading the Chamber's Energy Committee makes him a key Democratic vote on such issues, signaled his openness to carbon pricing by voting with his party on the measure. Several Republicans, including Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Mitt Romney of Utah, have said they are open to a carbon tax. But developing a consensus plan has proved difficult, with an array of proposals advanced on Capitol Hill in recent years. Some initiatives have lured Republican and business support by imposing a carbon tax in exchange for wiping away federal regulation of carbon dioxide emissions, a trade-off many environmentalists staunchly oppose. Still, other thorny questions surround how carbon tax revenue would be used, with some proposals calling for the money to be rebated to American taxpayers, and others pushing for proceeds to go to environmental restoration projects and revitalizing coal communities. This article is entitled, India Urges OPEC Plus to Raise Oil Output at This Week's Meeting, by Dina Krenikova and Olga Tanas, Bloomberg. India has reiterated its call to OPEC Plus to increase oil production from April as the alliance meets this week to discuss future steps. Artificial cuts to keep the price going up is not something we support, Tarun Kapoor, secretary at India's Ministry of Petroleum and Natural Gas, told reporters in Moscow on Wednesday at the opening of India's energy center. It's not the first time India, one of the biggest buyers of the producer group's crude, has urged the OPEC of exporting petroleum countries and its partners to pump more oil. In January, when Saudi Arabia surprised the market with a voluntary production cut of 1 million barrels a day in February and March, Indian oil and gas minister Dharmendra Pradhan said such policy is contraindication is creating confusion for the consuming countries. Higher crude prices amid the OPEC Plus deal were also harming the global economic recovery, Pradhan said last month. The 23-nation coalition continues to idle just over 7 million barrels of daily output, about 7% of global supply. And on Thursday, we'll decide whether to revive a 500,000-barrel tranche in April. In addition, the Saudis will confirm whether an extra 1 million barrels they've recently taken offline will return as scheduled. Crude prices rallied to pre-pandemic levels at the end of February, buoyed by the rapid drawdown of stockpiles and U.S. production being impacted by severe winter storms. While the market expects that the coalition, led by Saudi Arabia and Russia, will agree to an increase in production, the pace of recovery and output remains unclear. This is the energy page. This article is entitled, Oil Settles Below $60 Before Meeting About Supply, by Andres Guerra-Luz, Bloomberg. Oil tumbled below $60 a barrel in New York, with the OPEC Plus alliance said to be set to agree to a production increase later this week. U.S. crude futures fell 0.9% to the lowest in more than a week on Tuesday, while its global counterpart, Brent, hit a two-week low. The widespread view among the producer group is that the market can absorb additional barrels, according to people familiar with the matter. That could put the alliance on track to implement the majority of the 1.5 million barrel a day output hike that's up for debate on Thursday. Oil's underlying market structure also has weakened this week. The backwardation, an indication of tightening supplies, seen in key time spreads, is shrinking. At the same time, some pockets of physical oil market strength appear to be wobbling, with observed flows of North Sea crude grades to Asia dropping in February to the lowest in 4 months. West Texas Intermediate for April delivery fell 89 cents to settle at $59.75 a barrel. While the Saudi surprise cut really kick-started this move higher, the unwinding of that will be more difficult for the market, said Edward Moya, senior market analyst at Oanda Corporation. There is still significant risk for the short-term outlook. Crude has rallied more than 20% since the start of the year, with support from a range of factors, including Saudi Arabia's unilateral output cuts, the rollout of vaccines, and an investor change into commodities have also underpinned the gains. Even if OPEC and its allies restore 2.4 million barrels a day of crude output by June, global oil inventories are set to decline each month this year, according to an OPEC Plus panel. India has reiterated a call for the group to increase its production from April. Prices were getting elevated enough that stabilizing the market makes sense, said Bill O'Grady, Executive Vice President at Confluence Investment Management in St. Louis. It is a difference between what was expected and what was hoped. What you expect is that they will raise production. What you hope is that they don't. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and its allies must decide how much output is to be restored, with current reductions totaling just over 7 million barrels a day. The group is the largest actor in the oil market, with collective production covering more than 40% of worldwide demand. Saudi Arabia always said that its voluntary supply reduction would only last for 2 months. The kingdom will start to roll back its extra cut as planned in April, but is still discussing internally whether to return all of the barrels in a single month or over a longer period, said people familiar with the deliberations. Meanwhile, oil shipments from OPEC's Persian Gulf producers edged higher last month despite the Saudi cut. Increased shipments from Kuwait and Iraq more than offset lower flows from the UAE and Saudi Arabia, vessel tracking data monitored by Bloomberg show. In the U.S., crude inventories are expected to have declined last week, according to a Bloomberg survey. The industry-funded American Petroleum Institute will report its storage figures later Tuesday, ahead of a U.S. government report on Wednesday. This article is entitled, OPEC Production Plunges in February as Saudis Deliver Extra Oil Cutbacks, by Grant Smith and Julian Lee, Bloomberg. OPEC's crude production plunged last month as Saudi Arabia delivered extra cutbacks intended to clear the remnants of a global supply glut. Output from the group fell by 927 barrels a day, the biggest drop in 8 months, to 24.87 million a day, according to a Bloomberg survey. As promised, the kingdom slashed its production by almost 1 million barrels a day, or about 11%. As promised, the kingdom slashed its production by almost 1 million barrels a day, or about 11%. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and its allies have been constricting oil supplies since the pandemic crushed demand almost a year ago. To disperse the lingering stockpile surplus, the Saudis pledged extra reductions during February and March. Their efforts have paid off, reviving oil prices back to pre-crisis levels above $60 a barrel in London. The 23-nation coalition will meet on Thursday to decide whether it can relax some of the measures in April. It's widely expected they'll add 500,000 barrels a day of the 7 million barrels still offline, and that Riyadh will confirm the expiry of its additional million-barrel curb. Russia, which jointly leads the alliance, has signaled it's eager to proceed with a production increase. Saudi Arabia, wary that demand is still fragile and inventories plentiful, believes the producers should continue to be extremely cautious. Illustrating that sense of vigilance, the kingdom cut output by 970,000 barrels a day in February to 8.15 million a day, according to the survey. It's based on ship tracking data, information from officials, and estimates from consultants, including Rystad Energy AS, JBC Energy, GmbH, Rapidan Energy, and Energy Aspects Limited. Saudi exports. Despite the sharp production cut, OPEC's biggest producer kept exports broadly steady at 6 million barrels a day, tanker tracking data showed. Maintenance work at a domestic refinery allowed the kingdom to keep shipments unchanged, Energy Aspects said. While Riyadh made even bigger sacrifices than required last month, OPEC members who have often lagged behind in their commitment once again strayed. Iraq, which is supposed to be making extra compensatory cuts to atone for earlier overproduction, instead pumped more. Output rose by 40,000 barrels a day to 3.91 million a day, considerably above its mandated limit. As it reels from an economic crisis and reaches out to the International Monetary Fund for aid, Baghdad has put the need for revenues ahead of its obligations to OPEC. Nigeria had shown signs of better discipline at the end of last year, and in recognition, its oil minister, Timipre Silva, was sent to guide other African OPEC members in improving their performance. Yet the country lapsed again in February, boosting output by 130,000 barrels a day to 1.6 million. At the other end of the spectrum is Angola, which has lowered production far more than required by OPEC. Its output dwindled again last month by 80,000 barrels a day to 1.1 million, the lowest in Bloomberg data going back to 2007. Deficient investment has brought about a long-term slump in the oil industry of the country, which once vied with Nigeria as Africa's top producer. Despite government efforts to stimulate activity, just a handful of drilling rigs now work in the deep Atlantic waters that hold the nation's greatest resources. This article is entitled "Local Chin Population Concerned with Events in Former Home Country" by Stuart Doreen. The local Chin population inside Midland has concerns with what is taking place in the former home for many of them, Myanmar. The Associated Press has reported a coup in Myanmar has left the military in control under a one-year state of emergency. While the country's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, and other senior politicians have been detained. Having the military in control is a worry for Midlanders with family back in the former country of Burma, which is bordered by China to the northeast, Thailand to the southeast, and Bangladesh and India to the west. Solomon Chan, church secretary for Midland Chin Baptist Church, told the Reporter-Telegram this week that as long as the military is in control, that the people in Myanmar have no rights. He said that includes religion. He said that Buddhism is the main religion in the country, and that those in the military see Christianity as white people worship. And those practicing Christianity in Myanmar are oppressed, even having places of worship torn down. The Associated Press has reported that television signals were cut across the country, as was the phone and internet access in Naypyidaw, the capital, while passenger flights were grounded. Phone service in other parts of the country was also reported down, though people were still able to use the internet in many areas. Also, barbed wire roadblocks were set up across Yangon, the largest city, and military units began to appear outside government buildings. Chan, 37, said that people he's been in touch with don't go anywhere. He said he and other Chin in Midland worry about human rights issues. Chan estimated the population of Chin people in Midland is greater than 1,000. He said there are 5 churches in Midland, and that Midland Chin Baptist Church has 495 members in Midland, an additional 25 to 30 that live outside the region. Chan said the growth of the Chin population in Midland started in 2007, and that word of mouth helped build the population, which includes around 400 that have become U.S. citizens. He said Chin community businesses owned include 3 Asian grocery stores and 4 sushi restaurants. He also said that Chin residents own around 200 homes in the community.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.